From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When the protest started, the Shell, they had a meeting, operatives of Shell in Nigeria and of those at The Hague in the Netherlands and in London held a meeting, and they decided that they would have to keep an eye on me and watch wherever I go to, follow me constantly to ensure that I do not embarrass Shell. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm a marked man where Shell are concerned.
Nigerian activist Ken Sarawiwa executed 2 years ago today, and a leaked internal report on Nike. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. An American spy plane safely flew over Iraq today, despite warnings from the Iraqis that it would shoot down the U-2 aircraft. The UN flight came hours before the Security Council meets to discuss Baghdad's refusal to cooperate with arms inspections. Iraqi military officials said the plane, which crossed into southern Iraq from northern Saudi Arabia, flew outside the range of its gunners, but that it monitored the aircraft with radar until it left Iraqi airspace 3 hours later. President Clinton says the United States will seek a, quote, very strong and unambiguous response from the Security Council today to compel Iraq to give free passage to international inspectors charged with preventing President Saddam Hussein's government from developing weapons of mass destruction. In Baghdad, Saddam made a public statement that suggested he's unyielding. Appearing on Iraqi television, he said his country has to choose between sacrifice or slavery, and that people must decide to live honorably and with dignity, or to face all the possibilities. The latest Iraq conflict began late last month after Saddam's government blocked the UN Special Commission, known as UNSCOM, charged with ensuring that Iraq does not develop chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons programs, and insisted that Americans be removed from the inspection team. Clinton aides say their first resort before the Security Council will be sanctions, including a possible prohibition on travel by Iraqi leaders rather than military action. At this stage, they acknowledge the latter option could not draw broad support among other nations. President Clinton has made another plea for expanded trade negotiating power, but appeared unable to sway more than a handful of the vast majority of House Democrats standing firmly against him. After a weekend of frenetic lobbying, the fate of the legislation President Clinton has called crucial appeared increasingly to be in the hands of House Speaker Newt Gingrich and the Republicans. In a nod to the political clout of the gay rights movement, President Clinton on Saturday addressed a fundraiser for the nation's largest gay and lesbian group. Clinton's sold-out dinner speech to the Human Rights Campaign, which was greeted by a sustained standing ovation inside and pickets outside, made him the first sitting president to publicly address a gay and lesbian civil rights organization. Keeping to relatively non-controversial territory, he urged Congress to pass legislation protecting gay men and lesbians from job discrimination and to confirm Bill Lanley, his nominee as Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. France's far-right leader found allies in Eastern Europe Saturday, telling a party congress of extreme Romanian nationalists he rejects the notion of a united Europe. Jean-Marie Le Pen and Corneliu Vadim Tudor, the leader of the Greater Romania Party, share the same hyper-nationalist xenophobic rhetoric. The party came in fourth in last year's election. They both reject the idea of a united Europe and urge a so-called Europe of Nations, a region of separate, intensely nationalistic countries. About 2,000 delegates and guests at the two-day Greater Romania Party Congress cheered the two leaders, shouting their names and waving flags. That meeting took place in Bucharest. Tomorrow is Veterans Day. A third of homeless men seeking shelter are veterans in this country, mostly combat veterans from the Korean, Vietnam, or the Persian Gulf conflicts. This according to a Veterans Day survey that was released this weekend. Phil Reidman, a spokesperson for the International Union of Gospel Missions, a network of rescue missions that conducted the survey, says that what used to be called shell shock and is now referred to as post-traumatic stress syndrome sets in at different times, accounting for the continuing flow of Vietnam veterans into missions 20 years after the war. The survey of 11,000 men seeking shelter in 58 missions in late October showed 32% were veterans. By comparison, Veterans Administration figures show about 19% of the male population are former members of the armed forces. A senior Senate Democrat asked Saturday for a new hearing on the embattled nomination of Bill Landley to head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy, ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, asked the panel's chair, Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, to hold another hearing to give Lee a chance to answer allegations leveled by House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Gingrich, in a letter sent last month to Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, said Lee tried to force through a consent decree requiring racial and gender preferences in the Los Angeles Police Department. Lee is Western Regional Counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund based in Los Angeles. President Clinton nominated him to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Justice Department. And that's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today marks the second anniversary of the execution of West African author and activist Ken Sarawiwa. As head of Nigeria's MOSOP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, he led a campaign against the ecological devastation that petroleum giant Shell was causing in his homeland, the oil-rich region of Nigeria called Ogoni Land. The protests targeted the company's abusive practices and even caused a partial shutdown of some of its facilities. But the Nigerian military regime, led by General Sani Abacha, launched a wave of fierce repression against the Ogoni, which led to the hanging of Ken Sarawiwa and eight other men on November 10, 1995, in the yard of Port Harcourt Prison. 2.5 years ago, Ken Sarawiwa came to Pacifica radio station WBAI in New York. My co-host Bernard White and I interviewed Sarawiwa and another official of MOSOP, Led Emete. This is an excerpt of that interview. It begins with Ken Sarawiwa.
Well, Shell does not want to negotiate with the Ogoni people. Each time they've come under pressure from local people, their want has always been to run to the Nigerian government and to say to the Nigerian government, oil is 90% of your foreign exchange earning. If anything happens to oil, your economy will be destroyed. Therefore, you must go and deal with these people, these troublemakers. And most times, the government would oblige them and visit local communities, poor, dispossessed people with a lot of violence. And when these communities then protested and said, look at the amount of violence that is being used against us, even though we are only protesting peacefully, then the oil companies will come and say, well, there is no way we can determine how much violence a government decides to use against its own people. So basically, the local communities have no leverage with the oil companies at all.
Who is the government now of Nigeria?
There is a military government in power at this time, and indeed military people have been in power in the country for a long time.
Because they suspended the results of the elections?
Yes, indeed. But for a long time now, Nigeria has been under military dictatorships, and the oil companies like military dictatorships because basically they can treat with these dictatorships. The dictatorships are brutal to people, and they can deny the rights of human rights of individuals and of communities quite easily, without compunction.
Ken Sarawiwa, how does the oil companies, how do Shell and Chevron deal with you as the president of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People?
Well, recently, when the protest started, the Shell, they had a meeting, operatives of Shell in Nigeria and of those at The Hague in the Netherlands and in London held a meeting. And they decided that they would have to keep an eye on me, watch wherever I go to, follow me constantly to ensure that I do not embarrass Shell. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm a marked man where Shell are concerned. And indeed, I have been in detention in Nigeria several times. My passport has been impounded. The last time round, in the middle of June, I was held for 31 days without charge, and eventually
The Nigerian government
held me, shunted me from prison to prison, And it's only international concern that allowed them to send me on bail. Early this year, on the 2nd of January to be precise, I was placed under house arrest with my entire family for 3 days in order to stop a planned protest against Shell. 300,000 Ogoni people were going to move to protest the devastation of the environment by Shell and the other multinational oil companies. And it was in the interest of these companies to ensure that I was not, that this demonstration did not hold. And all they did was simply send the military authorities to my house. They disconnected my telephones, confiscated the handsets. And I was held for 3 days without food.
In fact, even before then, not only himself, almost all the leaders of the movement have always been harassed. In fact, before he came, before his own ordeal, the recent ordeal he mentioned about, myself and his younger brother, Dr. Onwenwa, were picked up about 2 a.m. and locked up in detention. We spent 9 days for no charge had been preferred for that. They just put us in, according to them, to make sure that the anniversary of the Ogoni people for the protest do not take place.
What was detention like? I mean, what did...
Oh, it's horrible. We were thrown into a place, into a room without beds, without carpet, the toilets were not there. In fact, we were not fed until for about, out of the 9 days, we were fed only about 2 days. And in fact, even the doctor was sick. He complained that he needed medical attention. No one bothered to talk to him. It was a very horrible experience we had.
And what does the Nigerian government say in explaining why they detain you?
Well, all they say is that they don't want the Ogoni people. You see, they feel that we've got so much courage, I mean, for daring to have the courage to challenge the multinational and the government, then at least the leaders should be put away for some time.
So there's no pretense, then? They are saying it's because of your leadership in the Ogoni people's movement?
No, not at all. They actually say that because of the leadership of the Ogoni movement. That's exactly what they are doing.
Ken Zarawewa and Ledham Mitta, how come you have come to be head of the movement? What is your background?
I'm a writer. I started as an academic, a university teacher. Subsequently, during the Nigerian Civil War, had a place in government. And after that, I set up as a shopkeeper. And subsequently, I became a television producer. And I write novels and short stories and poems and television comedy and essays and everything else, or poetry. But it was my literature that led me to the severe injustices which we're suffering in Nigeria, and which the Ogoni people have had to endure in the hands of the oil companies. When I put all that was happening under the cold on a stare of logic, I found that there was something immensely wrong. And I began to mobilize the Ogoni people to struggle for their environmental and human rights and against the military dictatorship and the cruelty, the environmental terrorism of the oil companies. So I came to activism through literature. And I was able to form the movement for the survival of the Ogoni people and to involve virtually every Ogoni man, woman and child in this movement. They've become strong environmentalists.
Ken Sarawewa and Ledham Mitta. Ken Sarawewa and Ledham Mitta went back to Nigeria after the interview we did with them at Pacifica Station WBAI in February of 1994. They were arrested, detained, and then given a pseudo-trial. Ledham Mitta was eventually found innocent. Ken Sarawewa, along with 8 other activists, were condemned to death, and they were executed 2 years ago today in Port Harcourt Prison in Nigeria. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Today in Nigeria, security agents are waging an intimidation campaign to block protests marking the anniversary of the execution that turned Nigeria into an international pariah. The Nigerian junta has deployed troops across the home region of Ken Saro-Wiwa, a playwright and activist hanged 2 years ago today. The junta also detained Saro-Wiwa's nephew, activist Boniface Januari-Wiwa, and sent agents to Saro-Wiwa's 69-year-old mother several times in the past week to intimidate the family. This according to the opposition newspaper known as Punch. In the Niger Delta region, home to 500,000 Ogoni minority, troops were deployed over the weekend to block the movement for the survival of the Ogoni people from holding any events to mark the anniversary of Saro-Wiwa's death. Abacha's critics claim the nine were executed because of their anti-government activities and attempts to win compensation from international oil companies like Shell, whose operations damaged Ogoni croplands and fishing waters. The hangings galvanized international opposition to Abacha, prompting the Commonwealth, the 54-nation association of Britain and its former colonies, to suspend the country, and leading South African President Nelson Mandela to call for international sanctions on Nigerian oil. We're joined right now by Owens Wiwa. He's an official with MOSAP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, and he's the brother of the late Ken Saro-Wiwa. He speaks to us from Canada. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Ami.
Why don't we start with what is happening in Nigeria today? From this report from the opposition paper Punch newspaper, we see that your nephew has been detained, that your mother is being harassed by Nigerian security agents.
That's quite unfortunate. My mother has had so many harassment and arrest and intimidation so many times in this world, you know, that most people have known. But she will go through this, and I hope that they will release my nephew also. However, since Thursday, last week, the Ogoni people have been celebrating and preparing for this day, and a series of demonstrations have been held in remembrance of Ken in many villages, knowing fully well that by today, the whole place will be sealed up more with the by the army. We also have some arrests of some student leaders who have been involved in organizing the people, especially their parents, Mr. Kobo, the mother, and one of his brothers were arrested by the military. Arrest, detention, torture, and even extrajudicial killing has been quite commonplace in Ogoni. This has been done by the military dictatorship in order to stop our protests, to stop our vision. But our vision is simple. We are still using the principles of nonviolence and the empowerment of the people to seek social justice by eliminating the poverty and the inequities brought about by the alliance of Shell and the Nigerian military. We hope to continue, and we want to make Ken proud that his vision is still alive.
Can you tell us, Owens Wiwa, what happened 2 years ago, just before Ken was executed, when it came to this military tribunal that heard Ken Saro-Wiwa's case, as well as the others, and if Shell actually played a role in this tribunal?
Well, there's no doubt that Shell played a role. I was declared wanted, you know, for the unfortunate death of four of our chiefs. And I immediately went underground, and I was in Lagos, the capital city, meeting up with some of the military friends I have and members of the diplomatic corps and even all the power brokers in Nigeria. I also met with the head of Shell, because we had noticed in the tribunal itself that the presence of a military officer, Lieutenant Colonel Okuntimo, whom we know have been having meetings with officials of Shell in Port Harcourt, and have also told people that he's been paid by Shell to do the things he's been doing in Ogoni to, in quote, protect their equipment. Apart from that, there was a Shell lawyer present on some occasions in the tribunal. And knowing the power of Shell producing over 50% of the nation's income, we did know that they have a role to play. So I actually went to see the British ambassador, and that I wanted to see the head of Shell, and he arranged a meeting, and I saw the man, and he said, basically, over the meetings we have, that we should write a press statement saying that there was no environmental devastation in Ogoniland, call off the international protest that was going on to free Ken and eight of our colleagues, and then he is going to act.
Owens-Wiwa, we're going to find out more what your response was when Shell said call off the international protests, and then what we'll see what happens with Ken Saro-Wiwa. But we do have to break. Owens-Wiwa, the brother of Ken Saro-Wiwa, also an official in MOSOP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. And when we come back, we'll be joined by some other Nigerian activists talking about what's happening on the ground in Nigeria and how people are organizing in this country today. And after that, we'll talk about a leaked report on Nike. Stay with us here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Maniu sundur mangi wo bepp domu Africa ñu bokku xalat bokku gis gis bokku yene sans frontière bolé sunu am am té ligéy nañu dajé baña xajal kenn sunu digënté waratuñu nangu kenn ñew di ñu féwolé bul jité réw fokk né la fa nek yow ya ko mo ngir bu dëgë dala wara fekk nga bëgg sa réw bi saxu nimbal nimbal na ca fek loxol borom ni
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, continuing our conversation with Owens-Wiwa, brother of the late Ken Saro-Wiwa, executed 2 years ago today with eight other Ogoni activists in Nigeria as they were protesting what was happening to their homeland as a result of Shell Oil and other multinational oil companies and their drilling in the Ogoni region of Nigeria, the most populous country of Africa. Now, Owens-Wiwa is a master student at Johns Hopkins University, a master student in public health. He's currently in Canada, again, also an official with the Movement for the Organization, Movement for the Survival of Ogoni People. When they said to you, when this Shell official said to you, Owens, that if you call off the protests, what would happen to Ken, who was at that time in prison?
If we call off the protest, they said they are going to act and to say that Ken and others are free. And I told them immediately that I cannot do that. I don't have the power to do that. But however, I am going to write to Ken and others in prison, which I did. And of course, Ken said that there's no way we're going to lie about the environmental devastation in Ogoniland, or even to call off the protest. That if Shell do their work, there will be no protest. If there's no environmental devastation, there will be no protest. If there's no abuse of human rights, there will be no protest.
Earlier, you referred to the fact that Ken and the others were arrested on the pretext that there had been killings of four Ogoni chiefs and that they were responsible for galvanizing others to kill the Ogoni chiefs. I think it's interesting to note in the interview we played with Ken Saro-Wiwa and Leda Mete that Ken was continually harassed and arrested by the Nigerian military authorities. That latest pretext, the killing of the Ogoni chiefs, was just one more reason to have him either house detained or put in prison.
Well, that is true. Actually, the first time Ken got arrested or detained ever in his life was only after the massive protest in 1993, where 100,000 people came out from Ogoni to demonstrate against the environmental double standards of Shell. And after that, there has been a going on. Now, arresting somebody and framing the person for murder is not new that much in Ogoni when we're talking about oil. We also have one Professor Chinwa, who is from another oil-bearing community in the Niger Delta that was actually detained for over 3 months, and the charge on his head was murder. And he was put in such a way, I met him in detention in 1994 also, when I was also detained for murder, which I did not commit. I mean, I'm a physician, and I was going to look at people that have been shot, to take them in my ambulance to my clinic, but I was held by the military and put in that time for 3 weeks for murder. I was only saved because Ken came back and then raised such a lot of a noise in the press, and also because Amnesty International also issued an urgent alert on my behalf, and because I went with a journalist who also reported what happened. If Ken had been with a journalist that day, and if pressure had really come as strong as we wanted, it's possible that he would have been with us today. But the military dictatorship wanted to do anything. Shell wanted to do anything that will remove Ken and some other Ogoni people from the scene.
Dr. Owens Wiwa, brother of Ken Sarawiwa, official in MOSOP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. We're also joined by Goodluck Debo, who is a former confidant of Ken Sarawiwa and a head of the youth arm of MOSOP. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you and good morning.
Good luck. Good morning. Can you tell us about the day that you were driving in the car with Ken in Nigeria? The military official stopped you and said you could not go into Ogoni land.
Yeah, that was a pre-planned effort by the military to implicate us in what was already planned ahead, because that was the same day that four elders or chiefs of Ogoni were murdered. We were on a peaceful trip to hold peaceful rallies in Ogoni to educate our people about the constitutional conference that was to take place in Nigeria at that time. And we did not know that the military already had planned some other strategies to blackmail us, and I think that was the day that the four chiefs were eventually killed. Ken and myself and his driver and the orderly that were in the car with us were turned back from Ogoni. We were told we cannot hold any peaceful rally in Ogoni, and that we should get out of Ogoni, not just returning to our homes in Ogoni. In fact, Ken wanted to visit the mother on that day, and he was told that he cannot visit the mother, and that if he wants to, that they would accompany him to visit the mother. So we were turned back from Ogoni that day, and we returned to Port Harcourt. And on getting to Port Harcourt, we actually went to the newspaper, a newspaper called Sunray, and we narrated the story to a team of editorial staff at that newspaper house, and at that point, a question was raised as to whether Ken has informed the military administrator of what has happened. And right in that newspaper house, Ken made a call to the military administrator's office. The wife received the call and told us that the administrator has been...
Who received the call?
The wife of the administrator answered the call and told us that the administrator has been very anxious to see Ken. And okay, Ken left a message and said, let him call him back. The administrator did not call Ken back. When Ken and I and others learned of the incident, we got this information about the killing from the newspaper house that we went for a discussion earlier in the day. And we went back to that same newspaper only to discover that the news was brought to the newspaper house by an Ogoni judge. And we traced the Ogoni judge to his house, and we were later told he has gone to the Commissioner of Police office.
Now, you're talking about the news of the killing of the four Ogoni chiefs, and you were all at the newspaper office doing interviews.
Yes, I'm giving you this background because I think it's necessary for us to understand that Ken was not involved, and that when the news came to us, we did everything humanly possible to find out the source of that news, and even went straight to the administrator's to the government house that evening. And the administrator, whom the wife told us was anxious to kick in, refused to see Ken. And so I'm saying this to let the world understand that this was a cover-up by the administrator, and it did not take him 24 hours to announce that Ken was responsible for the killing of the four elders. There was no investigation. There was no an arrest of others in the community. It was focused directly on. So I think it was an attempt to blackmail Ken and to ensure that he was eliminated. And again, my own organization, the National Youth Council of Ogoni People, was alleged to have been responsible for the killing, and that the instruction was passed on to the organization by Ken. And I want to say that this was also done because the National Youth Council of Ogoni People,
NYCOP, which NYCOP, is a part of MOSAP.
NYCOP, I'm very proud to say that NYCOP had been at the forefront of the struggle, and because this is an organization of more than 100,000 people, if the military had been able to crush that organization, I think the struggle would have been, to an extent, aborted, because the youth were actually at the forefront of the struggle. So Ken was not responsible. Those men that were killed were a great loss to the Ogoni people, and we are still insisting that the international community can still do something about it. There could be an international tribunal to investigate what happened to those four men, because to deny people of their right to life is something that is not acceptable under international law. Why must it be ignored?
We should also say that there are still 19 other Ogoni activists who remain in prison, and lest anyone think that the killings and the torture have stopped. We're also joined in the studio by a man we'll call Asterisks. He is a Nigerian, does not want to be identified. He was picked up by the Nigerian military last year and tortured. Can you tell us about your circumstance?
Well, let me start by saying that elimination by the Nigerian government is just the last stage of what they do to opposition. They start with arrest, detention, and torture. I was picked up in January last year, and I will tell you that torture for me was a fate worse than death at the hands of the military. I was put in the trunk of a car by presidential bodyguards. And
bodyguards of Sunny Abacha?
Yes. You still have them in Lagos, even though the government has moved to Abuja. I don't know what presidential bodyguards are doing in a city like Lagos. And they took us, they took me in particular, to their facility where they detain people. And they handcuffed me and hung me up from a wall. I was hanging by my hands, and they put tear gas in my eyes. It's some kind of stimulant that is meant to make you cry. And when they were done with that, they lay me on the floor and used poles to beat me. Of course, by this time, they had stripped me naked. They used wooden poles to, like, really, you know, bash my head. And that was just the beginning. It was the introduction. Later on, one of the guards asked me, you know, have you been beaten? I said, yes. He looked at the blood on my hands and he said, you haven't been beaten. And I was wondering what worse could come. And that was just a welcome dose for me. The next few days, the next weeks, were just torture unlimited.
Why did they pick you up?
Now, the son of the head of state had died in a plane crash.
Sunny Abacha's son.
Sunny Abacha's son, who was jetting around in a presidential jet and crashed. And some of us had done the analysis, and we had said that Ken Saro-Wiwa's body, after he was hung, was bathed with acid, you know, and really burnt, and that the same thing had happened to General Sani Abacha's son, that his son's body was not recovered from the plane. And so we felt that it was God who was saying, hey, listen, you did this to Ken, now God has done this to you. And the guards were just really very mad. They went on an arresting spree. They arrested lots of people. And in my case, I was one of those that they picked up and locked in, took away in the trunk of a car. And I'll tell you, it's a horrifying experience.
How long were you held for?
I was held for a total of 8 months.
How did you get out?
How did I get out of the country?
How did you get out of prison and the country?
Oh, well, now I am aware that the Commonwealth was planning to visit Nigeria and see political detainees and all that. And so the government wanted to clear out its stables before the Commonwealth came. And
to
so
investigate?
Yes, to investigate. So they released a few of the bad cases.
So you got out of prison, and how'd you get out of the country?
Now, I would want to say that for the sake of many others who want to flee, I wouldn't want to disclose my route.
And that is a man who we will not identify further than to say he was tortured in Nigeria in this past year. Dr. Owens-Wiwa, what about today, and particularly U.S. policy? We did a show about a month ago with Hafsat Abiola, the daughter of Masoud Abiola, the elected president of Nigeria, who remains in jail now for a number of years since the election, and also the daughter of Kudirat Abiola, who was gunned down on the streets of Lagos, Nigeria, 2 years ago, her mother. She was on the show with Wole Soyinka, Nigerian Nobel laureate, and she was in New York because the New York City Council was considering passing legislation that would change the name of the street on which the Nigerian UN mission sits to Kudirat Abiola Way. It ultimately was changed just 2 weeks ago. The City Council voted almost unanimously to change the street, despite the fierce opposition of the Nigerian government. And among those who testified was the former ambassador to Nigeria, Walter Carrington, who has since come back to this country. It's not clear if the reason he left Nigeria is because he became a thorn in the side of the Nigerian government and the Clinton administration, which is backing off serious sanctions against Nigeria, simply wanted him out. What is your view on that, and your view in general on U.S. policy towards Nigeria?
Well, specifically, if I can start from Ogoni, we are grateful for the humanitarian gestures, you know, by the administration in accepting some few dozens of Ogoni refugees and their family, but there has been no political nothing done politically, you know, in order to say that the situation of human rights abuse or democratization in Nigeria, you know, go the right way. We see a lack of a clear-cut policy by this administration to help the people of Nigeria to achieve a democracy, because we know about the oil interest, the American oil firms who are prospecting for oil in Nigeria. We also know that the United States alone takes more than 50% of the Nigerian oil that is coming. So, in effect, they are helping to sustain the military dictatorship of Abacha and the human rights abuses that go with it.
Do you think there's a chance Clinton would call for sanctions, oil sanctions against Nigeria?
We have been calling for sanctions. We continue to call for sanctions because that is one of the most effective way of saying that the Abacha do not get the weapons to get to buy the weapons of repression. But we are happy that the Americans and the people of New York have been able to effect the change of the street naming in where the Nigerian embassy is. That will show the Nigerian military that what they are doing is not acceptable to the ordinary Americans. If only the Clinton administration would take the view of most Americans that I have been opportune to meet, we would be happy. Walter Carrington, while he was in Nigeria, was very helpful to the pro-democracy groups. We met him several times when Ken was in detention, and he did make some statements, you know, which we thought would change the views of the Abacha regime. But we were also pointing out that the only thing that affect the military is the oil money. They do not really care about any other thing. It is the oil. And we are happy about those who are boycotting Shell, who are not buying from Shell. And today especially, all the way from India to Finland, Johannesburg, in Republic of Benin, Ghana, and here in Canada and many places in the United States, there are demonstrations going around. And I'm sure that Ken would have been proud and that the struggle has continued, even grown, as more organizations, you know, are committed to seeing that victory is done for the Ogoni people. And we remember him. We remember the over 2,000 Ogoni people who have been killed, and especially the Ogoni 20 who languish in jail today, who are sick, are not allowed visitors, and we do not know what the military dictatorship wants to do with them. We have been pleading with Abacha, with Shell, not to allow these 20 to die, because they are innocent. They are as innocent as I am today.
On that note, we do have to wrap up on the second anniversary of the execution of Ken Sarawiwa and eight other Ogoni activists in Nigeria. The phone number of the movement for the organization, the Movement for the Survival of Ogoni People, Owens-Wiwa?
Yes, here in Toronto, it's 416-966-0910. In the U.S., you can call 773-643-5310.
I'm going to give that number in the United States one more time, 773-643-5310. Thank you very much for joining us, Owens-Wiwa, speaking to us from Canada, as well as Goodluck Debo, who is head of the youth arm of MOSOP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, and Asterix, who joined us telling his own story this year in Nigeria. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back on Nike in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, sportswear giant Nike has been embarrassed again. It has come under repeated attack by human rights and labor groups for the atrocious and exploitative conditions they say characterize the company's 150 factories that employ close to 500,000 workers across Asia. Nike has denied that it mistreats its workforce, even going so far as to hire former UN ambassador and civil rights leader Andrew Young to inspect the factories. After completing a two-week tour of 15 Asian factories, Young said earlier this year Nike was doing a good job. Nike also has hired an accounting firm, Ernst & Young, to look at charges of unsafe conditions at its factories. But Ernst & Young's confidential reports, completed 10 months ago, actually did find some serious abuses. So the public didn't know about that, because when an accounting firm does a report for a client, that becomes the property of that client, Nike. Well, Transnational Resource and Action Center, known as TRACS, a nonprofit research and advocacy group based in San Francisco, got a hold of one of those Ernst & Young reports. And we're joined by Dara O'Rourke, who is a research associate with TRACS. He's also a UN consultant, has lived in Vietnam for a number of years, and is the one who got a hold of this released report, this on the eve of tomorrow's White House meeting of the panel of both human rights groups and representatives of the apparel industry, who are hammering out some kind of deal around the issue of sweatshops and labeling of apparel that comes from sweatshops around the world. Dara O'Rourke, let's just begin with what it is that you found in this Ernst & Young report.
Yep, basically, the document shows that dangerous and unacceptable working conditions are endangering the lives of Nike workers in Vietnam. And Nike's own internal report which the Transnational Resource and Action Center is releasing to the public for the first time today, shows that hazardous and unjust conditions exist inside this, the most technologically advanced Nike factory in Vietnam. But then my own research, what I saw from three visits to this factory, as well as what I learned from interviewing workers away from the factory without a Nike translator, shows that the conditions are actually much worse than Ernst & Young report in this internal document.
How did you get the document?
I had the opportunity to visit this factory three times to do my own walkthrough of the factory, looking at environmental conditions, to talk to managers, to talk to Nike employees in Vietnam, and to interview workers away from the factory. And during one of those meetings on a recent visit to Vietnam, a person leaked this to me.
Tell us what it says.
Basically, what the Ernst & Young document is, although I will criticize it extensively for a number of key omissions and poor work that they did, it's still, although a very poor document, it's very indicting of the conditions inside this Nike factory in Vietnam. It shows, first of all, that there are very dangerous working conditions. Of a sample of 165 workers, there's 9,000 workers in this factory, but of a sample of 165, 77%, more than 3 out of 4 of the workers had respiratory illnesses. It showed, for instance, high chemical overexposures. One solvent, toluene, which is a solvent used in hand cleaning of the shoes, was 177 times the legal limit, was the level of exposure. And this chemical causes respiratory ailments, central nervous system disorders, liver and kidney damage, skin and eye irritation. It's a serious problematic chemical. No workers in the factories essentially had protective equipment, which the Ernst & Young audit reports that there's basically no personal protective equipment. There's a high rate of accidents. There's no safety training in this factory. And the list goes on and on. The problem, however, is much worse than this. In my interviews and what I saw, I found that this audit had ignored many of the key issues going on inside this factory and many of the key issues of concern that have been raised about Nike factories around Asia. Issues that workers reported to me, violations of Vietnamese labor laws on overtime, forced overtime by workers, violations of Vietnamese labor laws on pay, violations of other Vietnamese environmental laws, reports of physical and verbal abuse by the managers of Vietnamese workers.
Explain some of these. Okay. Explain the abuse. Talk about what the minimum wage is and what they're getting paid.
Okay. So I'll start with pay, for instance. The minimum wage, the legal minimum wage in this province of Vietnam is $40 per month. And what that is, the standard work week in Vietnam is 6 days a week for 8 hours per day. However, some of the workers that I interviewed, their standard work week is actually 10.5 hours per day, 6 days per week. That's kind of the standard that the stitching section, for instance, does. The night shift of the stitching section every night is basically 11 hours per night, 6 nights per week. And then in addition to that, they have what they call overtime, which they're told about one day in advance and they're essentially forced to do. But for your basic work week, which is, say, 208 hours per month, you get paid $40. So they're getting about 19 cents per hour for working on producing these shoes.
So they're getting the pay of 40 hours, but they're working much more than that.
Well, this is a problem with this report, that the report only used management information on hours and on pay. And so from their own recording, which they present in this report, it would, if you calculate it, would show violations of Vietnamese wage laws. Either they're not working as much as they say they're working, or they're paying them below what they're supposed to be paying them. And then in my discussions with workers, they told me also that there's a number of different things going on in this factory. One is that some factories can get away with paying sub-minimum wage if they call it a training period for workers. Now, that apparently is a violation of Vietnamese laws, but some of these factories are getting away with it. Another thing is that they're supposed to pay increasing wages for each overtime hour, for instance, time and a half for overtime hours, or to pay increasing wages as workers improve their skills. The more senior workers should get paid higher wages. Those are things that workers reported were not happening. So there's a number of things going on with this pay. Unfortunately, the Ernst & Young audit, which was specifically supposed to be looking at these issues, didn't do a good job. They didn't talk to any workers off-site away from the factory. They didn't look for pay stubs. They didn't find out actual working hours and actual pay. That's one of the major omissions of this report. But even what they do show shows that there's problems.
When you say they didn't talk to workers away from the factory, right, what difference would that make?
Well, what they did was an interview with 50 workers that they say were randomly sampled. And they interviewed them in the factory. They had the list of the workers. And I believe that that's problematic for a number of reasons. One is that the workers are going to be afraid of repercussions for what they say, because these are sensitive issues. Are you being worked over the legal limit? Are you being paid under the minimum wage? These are things that the workers obviously are going to be concerned about being open and honest and critical. I mean, even myself, I wouldn't be open and honest and critical about my boss if he was sitting there taking notes on it. It's something that just... And this Ernst & Young team, which was hired by Nike, and which they say in the start of their audit is what they did was what they were specifically instructed to do by Nike. We believe this wasn't an independent group coming from the outside, and they weren't trusted by the workers. And so I think that there's good reason to call into question some of their findings. But even from their interviews, there's some interesting things. For instance, only just a little bit over half of the 50 workers they interviewed had any savings at all, reported that they could save any money from their salary. So Nike has claimed that these are great jobs with high salaries and that they're wanted by workers all over Asia. But that would indicate to me that these are jobs that people aren't getting rich off of, if only 27 of the 50 have any savings at all.
What about harassment and abuse?
So those were things that unfortunately Ernst & Young completely ignored. And those are key issues that have been raised all over Asia inside these Nike factories. And they don't look into it at all. But in my discussions with workers, they told me about several cases of physical abuse. For instance, one where a manager hit women with a broom to force them into a single file line to do something. Another where a factory manager beat up a Vietnamese guard for some transgression. Verbal abuse is continuous, they say. Disrespect of workers. There's just a long list of problems in the treatment. This factory also, there was a case last year where a factory manager reportedly attempted to rape two women. He was, accused of this, and he fled the country and left, and no charges were ever pressed against them, so he left the country. But according to the workers that I talked to, that happened.
We're talking to Darrow Rourke, research associate at the Transnational Resource and Action Center, known as TRAC, and a consultant with the United Nations in Vietnam. He got a hold of an Ernst & Young report, an internal report that was done by the accounting firm Ernst & Young for Nike and leaked to him when he was in Vietnam. I thought I'd play for you the comments of a Nike spokesperson just a few weeks ago. Listeners who listen regularly to Democracy Now! May remember this conversation. It was a debate between the Nike spokesperson and Ellie Smeal, who is the head of the feminist majority. And the Nike spokesperson was talking about how reputable accounting firms like Ernst & Young have really vindicated them.
Well, in fact, we've had an independent monitoring group, the accounting firm of Ernst & Young, and actually now Pricewaterhouse, monitoring our overseas practices for the last 3 to 4 years, including we've also had a well-renowned civil rights leader, Andrew Young, visit our factories just recently and come back with a report that basically these jobs exist in good working conditions.
That was Nike spokesperson Vashir Korpis. What's your response, Darrow Rourke?
I think this really is a critical issue, that this Ernst & Young report, which is the first one that has ever been made public, really sheds some light on the ability of these firms to do independent audits. And the first thing is it shows that Ernst & Young did not do a good job and may not be able to do a good job for a number of the reasons you mentioned, that they're not truly independent, that they're not trained to do labor and environmental auditing, and that they're not trusted by workers to do this thing. But then the second thing is that this audit, which Andrew Young claimed to have had access to, certainly calls into question his findings about Nike's performance, at least in Vietnam. So that would indicate to me that either he did not have access to all of the internal audits, and he did not see what's reported in this audit, that Ernst & Young reports respiratory illnesses at these rates and these kind of dangerous working conditions and these kind of treatment of workers. Either he didn't see those things, he wasn't shown those things, or he has a very different view of what a good job is than would most occupational safety and health experts around the world.
When Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor, he held what some called a sweatshop summit, others called the fashion industry summit. And there it became very clear what was going on in response to abuses by the fashion industry. There's this whole new area of business growing up, and that is the monitoring business. That is companies like Ernst & Young and others that are seeing a real market here, that corporations are being forced to say they have monitors, as opposed to independent human rights organizations already there on the ground. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the first page of the Ernst & Young audit says, we look forward to doing many more audits with you in Nike factories around Vietnam. So certainly it would indicate that there's potential conflict of interest for these firms who are interested in trying to get more business and to do more of these audits, and particularly firms that are being paid to do a specific task. They're being paid, in this case, to evaluate performance related to Nike's code of conduct. And in this case, although they note all these violations of Vietnamese laws, they say that this factory is in fact in compliance with Nike's code of conduct. That for me raises a red flag about conflict of interest or independence of this organization. But then the second point I think really is right of what you said, that we believe that only truly independent organizations, and the best case would be local organizations on the ground that speak the language, that can read the local press, that can follow up on issues in their region, would be the best organizations to do this. And we would recommend human rights organizations, labor or religious groups that are accredited, trained and accredited to do this kind of auditing would be the best auditors and the most independent, true independent auditors of these factories.
And yet, which direction do you see the wind blowing?
Well, on this White House Apparel Industry Partnership, Nike, who's a member of this partnership, is arguing very forcefully that their own accounting firm should be able to do the auditing. And that issue is going to be debated tomorrow, November 11th, and it's really, I think, a critical time for this debate in the U.S. about independent monitoring. Definitely Nike and the other industry members of that commission are pushing for their own accounting firms to do the audits. There are several members of the commission that are arguing otherwise, that we need truly independent auditors of U.S. manufacturers around the world if we're ever going to begin to get a handle on this global outsourcing, global production of garments and other products.
Who is arguing for independent monitors in this White House apparel industry partnership? Who's on it?
Well, there's at least three groups that I think are arguing for independent monitoring. The first is the International Labor Rights Fund, who is a prominent member of that and who's working on those issues. UNITE is also on that commission. And
the labor union.
Right. And there are two other groups that are also, I'm not sure exactly what their position is right now, but that are arguing that these accounting firms should be at least questioned about their ability to do these.
So they're outnumbered.
Absolutely.
What do you think people can do? This is happening tomorrow. The White House Apparel Industry Partnership is meeting. Can people around this country have an effect?
Well, I think there's definitely two things people can do. The first is I think people can call on Nike specifically and demand that they improve the conditions inside their factories. We believe that every Nike worker deserves safe working conditions, decent wages, and basic human dignity on the job. And it really is Nike's responsibility to guarantee that their own factories are treating workers in a fair and just way. And that's right now is just not happening. And Nike needs to take responsibility for that first off. But secondly, we believe that without independent monitoring and public accountability, these problems will not be solved. So we think that there needs to be some public pressure on this White House Apparel Industry Partnership and on other debates in the U.S. right now, because there are a number of things going on in Congress also about questions of sweatshop manufacturing. For instance, Bernie Sanders just passed a bill on child labor having to do with rugs. And there is an emerging debate in the U.S.
saying that they would be banned from the United States.
Right, to block imports.
Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont.
So there are a number of things going on, and I think that there absolutely is increasing awareness among American consumers about these issues, about sweatshop conditions around the world.
Dara O'Rourke, Research Associate at Transnational Resource Action Center. If you'd like to get the report on Nike from Ernst & Young, www.corpwatch.org. That's www.corpwatch.org. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette copy by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Leslie George is our director. Joe Gill and Errol Maitland engineered today's show. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!